I cry for you in
pain. In the limelight.
The cases of Carol Cadwalader and Paul Mason reveal how readily celebrated media figures are recruited to the intelligence services' covert information war against other journalists, says Jonathan Cook, author, in an article published under the heading British Watchdog Journalists Unmask as Lapdogs for the Security State. Stay tuned for more. Events suggest British journalism, the so-called Fourth Estate, is not what it purports to be, a watchdog monitoring the centers of state power. It is quite the opposite. The pretensions of the establishment media took a severe battering this month as the defamation trial of Guardian columnist Carol Cadwalader reached its conclusion, and the hacked emails of Paul Mason, a longtime stalwart of the BBC, Channel 4, and The Guardian were published online. Both of these celebrated journalists have found themselves outed as recruits in their differing ways to a covert information war being waged by Western intelligence agencies. Had they been honest about it, that collusion might not matter so much. After all, few journalists are as neutral or as dispassionate as the profession likes to pretend. But as have many of their colleagues, Cadwalader and Mason have broken what should be a core principle of journalism: transparency. The role of serious journalists is to bring matters of import into the public space for debate and scrutiny. Journalists thinking critically aspire to hold those who wield power, primarily state agencies, to account on the principle that without scrutiny, power quickly corrupts. The purpose of real journalism, as opposed to the gossip, entertainment and national security stenography that usually passes for journalism, is to hit up, not down. And yet each of these journalists, we now know, was actively colluding or seeking to collude with state actors who prefer to operate in the shadows out of sight. Both journalists were co-opted to advance the aims of the intelligence services. And worse, each of them either sought to become a conduit for or actively assisting covert smear campaigns run by Western intelligence services against other journalists. What they were doing, along with so many other establishment journalists, is the very antithesis of journalism. They were helping to conceal the operation of power to make it harder to scrutinize. And not only that, in the process they were trying to weaken already marginalized journalists fighting to hold the state power to account. We now know, courtesy of a Yahoo News investigation, that through 2017, the CIA hatched various schemes to either assassinate Assange or kidnap him in one of its illegal extraordinary rendition operations so he could be permanently locked up in the US out of public view. We can surmise that the CIA also believed it needed to prepare the ground for such a rogue operation by bringing the public on board. According to Yahoo investigation, the CIA believed Assange's seizure might require a gun battle on the streets of London. It was at this point, it seems, that Cod Valladar and The Guardian were encouraged to add their own weight to the cause of further turning public opinion against Assange. According to her witness statement, a confidential source in the U.S. suggested at the very time the CIA was mulling over these various plots that she write about a supposed visit by Farage to Assange in the embassy. The story ran in The Guardian under the headline, "When Nigel Farage Met Julian Assange." In the article, Cod Valladar offers a strong hint as to who had been treating her as a confidant. The one source mentioned in the piece is highly placed contact with links to U.S. intelligence. In other words, the CIA almost certainly fed her agency's angle on the story. In the piece, Cod Valladar threads together her and the CIA's claims of a political alignment between WikiLeaks' ideology, UKIP's ideology, and Trump's ideology. Behind the scenes, she suggests, was the hidden hand of the Kremlin guiding them all in a malign plot to fatally undermine British democracy. She quotes her highly placed contact, claiming that Farage and Assange alleged face-to-face meeting was necessary to pass information of their nefarious plot in ways and places that cannot be monitored. Except, of course, as her highly placed contact knew, and as we now know, thanks to exposes by Grey Zone website, that was a lie. In tandem with its plot to kill or kidnap Assange, the CIA illegally installed cameras inside as well as outside the embassy. His every move in the embassy was monitored, even in the toilet block. The reality was that the CIA was bugging and videoing Assange every conversation in the embassy, even the face-to-face ones. Far more plausible is what Farage and WikiLeaks say, that such a meeting never happened. Farage visited the embassy to try to interview Assange for his LBC radio show, but was denied access. That can be easily confirmed because by then the Ecuadorian embassy was allying with the US and refusing Assange any contact with visitors apart from his lawyers. Nonetheless, Cod Valladar concludes, in the perfect storm of fake news, disinformation, and social media in which we now live, WikiLeaks is, in many ways, the swirling vortex at the center of everything. The Farage-Assange meeting story shows how the CIA and Cod Valladar's agendas perfectly coincided in their very own swirling vortex of fake news and disinformation. She wanted to tie the Brexit campaign to Russia and suggest that anyone who wished to challenge the liberal PTs that provide cover for the crimes committed by Western regimes must necessarily belong to a network of conspirators on the left and the right, masterminded from Moscow. The CIA and other Western intelligence agencies, meanwhile, wanted to deepen the public's impression that Assange was a Kremlin agent and that WikiLeaks' exposure of the crimes committed by those same agencies was not in the public interest but actually an assault on Western democracy. Assange character assassination had already been largely achieved with the American public in the Russiagate campaign in the US. The intelligence services, along with the Democratic Party leadership, had crafted a narrative designed to obscure WikiLeaks' revelations of election fixing by Hillary Clinton's camp in 2016 to prevent Bernie Sanders from winning the party's presidential nomination. Instead, they refocused the public's attention on evidence-free claims that Russia had hacked the emails. For Cod Valladar and the CIA, the fake news story of Farage meeting Assange could be spun as further proof that both the far left and far right were colluding with Russia. Their message was clear. only centrist, and the national security state could be trusted to defend democracy. Cadwalader's smear of Assange is entirely of a piece with the vilification campaign of WikiLeaks led by liberal media outlets to which she belongs. Her paper The Guardian had Assange in its sights since its falling out with him over their joint publication of the Iraq and Afghanistan war logs in 2010. A year after Cadwalader's smear piece, The Guardian would continue its cooperation with the intelligence services' demonization of Assange by running an equally fabricated story, this time about a senior aide of Trump's, Paul Manafort, and various unidentified Russians secretly meeting Assange in the embassy. The story was so improbable, it was ridiculed even at the time of publication. Again, the CIA's illegal spying operation inside and outside the embassy meant there was no way Manafort or any Russians could have secretly visited Assange without those meetings being recorded. Nonetheless, The Guardian has never retracted this smear. The case of Paul Mason, who worked for many years as a senior BBC journalist, is ever more revealing. Emails passed to the Grey Zone website show the veteran, self-described left-wing journalist secretly conspiring with figures aligned with British intelligence services to build a network of journalists and academics to smear and censor independent media outlets that challenge the narratives of the Western intelligence agencies. Mason's concerns about left-wing influence on public opinion have intensified the more he has faced criticism from the left over his demands for fervent, uncritical support of NATO and as he has lobbied for greater Western interference in Ukraine. Both are aims he shares with Western intelligence services. Along with establishment media, Mason has called for sending advanced weaponry to Kiev, likely to raise the death toll on both sides of the war and risk a nuclear confrontation between the West and Russia. In published emails, Mason suggests the harming and relentless deplatforming of independent investigative media sites such as the Grey Zone, Consortium News, and Mint Press that host non-establishment journalists. He and his correspondents also debate whether to include declassified UK and open democracy. One of his co-conspirators suggests the full nuclear legal to squeeze them financially. Mason himself proposes starving these websites of income by secretly pressuring PayPal to stop readers from being able to make donations to support their work.
Aperture. Welcome back, everyone. In the first part, we saw how in 1951, inhabitants of a French village were suddenly tormented by terrifying hallucinations. At least seven people died, dozens were taken to a local asylum, and hundreds were affected. Immediately, wild theories started emerging to explain this mysterious case of mass insanity. There were claims of poisoned flour, contaminated water, and even witchcraft. The truth was stranger than any of these theories. The Central Intelligence Agency had spiked the local food with LSD as part of a mind control experiment at the height of the Cold War. And with time, U.S. government's interest in LSD shifted from a defensive to an offensive orientation. While the initial experiments with LSD were fairly simple, if shockingly unethical, Over time, these LSD experiments grew increasingly elaborate. Stay with us as victims reveal the naked truth in the next part of this program.
Entire populations bore the consequence of large-scale tests. Here are some examples. Again, uncontested cases that are recognized by the American government. In 1953, radioactive iodine was injected into newborns and pregnant women at Iowa University and also in Nebraska. In 1955, the CIA sprayed whooping cough bacteria off the coast of Tampa. Two died, and dozens fell ill. Also in 1955, the CIA enlisted prostitutes in San Francisco, opened two brothels and tested drugs on the clients, then filmed through a one-way mirror. In 1956, the Army released millions of mosquitoes carrying yellow fever and dengue on the towns of Savannah and Avon. There were several deaths and hundreds of people infected. In 1960, in Cincinnati, the Army financed a radiation program on 90 destitute or ill inhabitants of the city's University Hospital. Some died after several weeks. In 1966, the Army tested a virus in the New York Metro, then in Chicago. The bacteria was concealed in electric bulbs. The aim was to study the spread of chemical agents on a large scale. For these experiments, the Army or the CIA funded laboratories in the most prestigious universities: Yale, Stanford, Harvard, or Columbia. They all took part. Glorified by the idea of working for the nation's defense, the researchers went crazy.
Dr. Kligman in Philadelphia increases a dosage 468 times, which actually frightened Dow Chemical. They couldn't believe that a respected doctor would do that. In Washington, D.C., you had Walter Freeman, who was a very, very well-known lobotomist who traveled around the country doing lobotomies in his car. And he would use an ice pick. He could do 15 to 20 in a day. It was just incredible what some doctors did, and very few, if any, people in the hospital or the medical community blew the whistle on it. It really was an egregious act, and it showed that the medical community was more interested in protecting its ass than in protecting the test subject and the patients, because a lot of doctors went off the deep end and started doing things that are just inconceivable now.
To express his indignation, Alan Hornblum wrote half a dozen books. A former prison guard at Holmesburg in Pennsylvania, from his first day at work over 40 years ago, he had a horrible shock.
I was stunned to see scores of inmates with their shirts off, strapped and wrapped in bandages and gauze tape. And I couldn't imagine that I was going into an atmosphere that was that violent, because all of the men looked like they had just walked a saw block knife fight.
They explain that it's not because of any violence, but experiments that are carried out there. Alan was the first to denounce this scandal and would lose his job as a result.
It was probably the largest human experimentation factory in America, possibly the world. From 51 until 1974, more people were probably incorporated in more experiments than any other place in the world.
Drugs, viruses, cancerous cells, plutonium, sarin gas, the most toxic products were tested in Holmesburg, but also in dozens of prisons throughout the country. To condemn these experiments, Alan Hornblum found former inmates like Youssef. In 1961, this man was imprisoned for selling marijuana. He was poor, with limited education. He was offered a chance to take part in tests for a dollar a day. Since then, Yusuf has had his digestive tract operated on. He has liver and skin problems and can no longer work. His first test was for a bath foam from the company Johnson & Johnson.
They took tape and they stuck it on your back and pulled it off, stuck it on and pulled it off until the first layer of skin came off your back. And they put six sections on my back like that. And then they took a bottle with the Johnson & Johnson bubble bath in it and put it on a patch and put the patch over the raw area. Then they took a can. I recognized that can as being from the Army. And I was like, what Johnson & Johnson got to do with this? So he took the can and he sprayed it on my back. And when it hit my back, it was cold. But it was so toxic and like fumes, I could taste it in my mouth. And as I'm walking down, I'm getting dizzier and dizzier, dizzier and dizzier. By the time I stepped into my cell, I passed out. Boom, and my back was inflamed. And by the time I woke up that morning, I had great big blisters on my back full of pus. This rash just gets worse and worse. And it looks like when the moon come out at night, it flames up, and I'd be moaning and crying. My cell partners couldn't sleep. We goes over there, a little shot cup, and it looked like water. We drinks it. Everything became magnified, the sound, like the loudspeaker on the system. Ooh, ooh, ooh. The walls looked like they turned into water. You know what I mean? And like I spent the whole time like looking around like this here instead of doing the test. So I goes back to the block in that condition. And man, I mean, I was tripping. And it was like a slow-acting drug that was in that cup. It lasts for weeks. The inmates start naming me Outer Limits. I had no conversation for nobody. I was scared of the inmates, and the inmates act like they was afraid of me.
What you had were hundreds and hundreds of uneducated minorities, overwhelmingly black and Puerto Rican, and then you had white doctors with white lab coats with PhD or MD after their name, and it was a recipe for abuse, if not disaster. And those prison walls are an ideal spot to do controversial experiments, because just as those walls keep the inmates in, they also keep the public out, so no one finds out about it.
Prisoners were used, but also patients. In certain hospitals, patients were steered towards the services financed by the CIA. These services carried out limitless experiments on psychological manipulation. In 1965, Karen Wetmore was only 13 when she was admitted to a hospital in Vermont. She stayed there several times in her childhood. She suffered from severe depression after falling victim to a pedophile neighbor. Admitted against her will, she was not allowed any contact with her family, being told that it was for her own good.
The CIA was specifically looking for children between the ages of 13 and 18 to further dissociate. They wanted dissociative children. There's a sense of absolute and total helplessness. You're there, you're bound up, you're locked in this room. No matter how you scream, no matter what you say, no one is gonna come. It does something to you, something you don't get over.
The doctors went to work on Karen. They wanted to erase her memory and create a robot at their command. It took 30 years of legal battles for Karen to obtain her medical records and discover the violence of the treatments she was subjected to.
It says seclusion, full cam. A cam is a straitjacket. and ties, which means they tied my arms and they tied my feet. This goes on uninterrupted, day after day, week after week, February, March, April, right up until June 21st, 1971. You sleep on the floor, no blanket, no nothing. And my arms were secured like this, behind my back. I do remember that. It's extremely painful because it pulls on your neck, pulls on your shoulder. You can't get away from it. It's maddening is what it is, maddening. And I was naked. And I think that was part of the effort of that experiment to break me down. Everything they did was to break me down.
Months in a confined room with no bearings, while her captors administered all kinds of drugs and sometimes electric shocks at inhuman levels.
Number of shocks and the seconds that they held the shocks. 30, 30, 35, 35, 35, and they held it for sustained for 40 seconds. A normal shock would be a second. Certainly not 30 and 35 of them. One, not that many, which probably is what obliterated my memory right there. And I think that's the way they did it. They also said, in this treatment right here, no seizure, shock restarted. So they gave me a second one because they couldn't produce a seizure. So they must have done it over again, must have repeated it. It's unforgivable. And I'm sure I wasn't the only one they did this to. I'm sure. I survived to be able to talk about it.
How many suffered similar experiments? In Montreal, Canada, the CIA used a world-renowned psychiatrist to set up a factory of guinea pigs in the Allen Memorial Psychiatric Department in McGill University. This psychiatrist was Ewan Cameron, one of the all-powerful presidents of the World Psychiatric Association. In 1945, Ewan Cameron made the acquaintance of Rudolf Hess, one of the Nazis accused in the Nuremberg trial. In 1957, the CIA recruited him for their MK-Ultra program. The Americans wanted to perfect their interrogation techniques and program a human to kill. Ewan Cameron became the mad dog of psychiatry. He put his patients in vegetative states for several weeks while bombarding them with pre-recorded orders. Some would become incontinent, amnesiac, forgetting even who their parents were and how to speak. The Vermont hospital where Karen Wetmore was confined was working on the same program. In the hands of the CIA doctors, she was like a rag doll.
They used drugs like LSD. They used electric shock. They used chemical shock agent metrazole, which I was given in 1971. And I found that out in my medical records, which is a very brutal drug, CIA said it was excruciating physically and emotionally, excruciating drug. I have a quote from the CIA that said that the Soviets used it in the gulags and that a POW would say or do anything to avoid a second dose. Nice drug.
There's all kinds of people who believe and people who don't believe, and that's a debate about do you believe or don't believe. I'm always interested in what are in the documents saying. So the documents clearly describe implanting electrodes in people's brains, activating the electrode from a remote transmitter, and changing the person's behavior from angry, pounding the wall, sitting there just staring.
Behind Karen's ear is a scar, and she doesn't know what it's from.
Once my therapist really understood that I had really been experimented on by the CIA, she said to me, you know, just for the heck of it, let me look. Because we'd read about, there's been information about these implants. And I'm like, okay. And it was there, actually there. I showed you. I went to a plastic surgeon who told me it was a surgical scar, but there's nothing in my medical history, nothing in a medical record that shows any kind of problem ever behind my right ear, or any incision or any surgery or anything else. But there it is.
What stopped the journey down this destructive path? In 1973, while Watergate is rattling all the institutions, Richard Helms, director of the CIA, feels the winds of change. He works as a lone wolf and hasn't informed the president of these experiments. He knows he's crossed the line. To protect himself, he orders the destruction of all documents relating to the MKUltra program and its abandonment. 2 years later, in 1975, the President Gerald Ford orders an inquiry into the CIA. The Rockefeller Commission is sworn in. The task isn't simple, because at the heart of the CIA, even Richard Helms' close lieutenants know nothing about the brainwashing programs.
There's a lot of goofy things go on in a big agency like that with all that secrecy. Things can go on that you don't know about, that the people who are working for the director most closely don't know about, or that the director doesn't know about. I mean, they're keeping it quiet down there. You don't tell anybody. If it works, then we'll tell them. But, you know, in the meantime, don't get into any difficulties. I remember when they wanted to take a kitty cat and stick a microphone up its rear end and put an antenna on its ear and have him walk in if there's a spy in the park with another one, walk over and walk around and listen in on it. You know, they tried it one time in an experiment, and a taxi came by and ran over the cat, you know. So.
In reality, nothing is funny. In its haste to get rid of evidence, the CIA forgets 20,000 documents. A drop of water compared to the amount that was destroyed, but they reveal that it financed 149 programs, implicating 80 institutions, including the most respected. Called on to justify themselves, the heads of the CIA, like Dr. Lashbrook, lie and downplay the facts.
There was, of course, claims or thoughts that maybe great things could be done with hypnosis. One small project in which we had a hypnotist do some experiments, primarily to see what the limitations of hypnosis might be. Can you make a person do something under hypnosis that he would not ordinarily do?
Even if the head of the CIA, Richard Helms, tried to minimize the scale of the experiments, the victims' testimonies contradict him.
The next thing I remember,
the inquiry commissions follow, each reaching more and more witnesses, like this woman, Chris DeNicola. Her father put her in the hands of a reputed CIA doctor, Dr. Green, when she was 12 years old.
His objective was to gain control of my mind and train me to be a spy assassin. Dr. Green had electrodes on my body, including my head. He used what looked like an overhead projector and repeatedly said he was burning different images into my brain while a red light flashed aimed at my forehead. In between each sequence, he used electric shock on my body and told me to go deeper and deeper, while repeating each image would go deeper into my brain and I would do whatever he told me to do. Dr. Green moved on to wanting me to kill dolls that look like real children.
Inquiry reports that resulted from these terrifying testimonies revealed one thing for certain. The experiments ended in disaster. In its insane quest for a robot human or a truth serum, the CIA failed. On August 3rd, 1995, with the revelations mounting up, then-President Bill Clinton makes a public apology. Since then, a great number of secret archives have been released to the public domain. Researchers would take an interest in this troubled period, notably Hank Alberelli, who worked on the suspicious death of Frank Olson, the biochemist who worked at the heart of the CIA. Since 1951, the year of the Pont-Saint-Esprit incident, Frank Olson called into question the ethics of the experiments being carried out and became depressed as a result. In November 1953, the CIA put LSD into his glass without him knowing. 9 days later, he threw himself off the 13th floor of a New York hotel. Murder or suicide, we'll never know. At the time of the investigation, Hank Albarelli found a surprising document coming from the White House. It surprisingly linked the name of Frank Olson to Pont-Saint-Esprit. Why, in the middle of the Korean War, would the White House be interested in this small French village? Even better, Hank also came across a study carried out by the CIA on LSD.
The document itself was a comprehensive overview or history, if you will, of LSD specifically, yes. Not on ergot, had nothing to do with ergot. There was a section or a chapter, if you will, headed incident at Pont-Saint-Esprit. And the first two paragraphs of that describe essentially what we've all read, you know, many times over in terms of what happened at Pont-Saint-Esprit. But the remainder of that section, the rest of that page, which was about half the page, and the two pages that followed, were completely blacked out.
Above all was this damning document from the CIA. It dates from 1953 and has no doubt been declassified by mistake. A director at Sandoz Laboratories confirmed to a secret agent that the Pont-Saint-Esprit incident was caused by LSD. Sandoz Laboratories was where Albert Hofmann worked, the man who discovered LSD. It even claimed the drug was responsible for the Pont-Saint-Esprit tragedy before recanting. This same document states that in 1952, the source at the CIA had already explained that the cursed bread was caused by LSD. Did French authorities try to silence the affair? Several years after the drama, a head of the Victims Association was shocked at how disinterested the investigators were. Do the French have something to hide? We've interrogated former members of the Secret Services, investigated national and regional archives, as well as those from the police and the Justice Department. The files are hard to find, and many important pieces, such as reports from main hearings, have disappeared. If America revealed unwillingly some of its secrets about its participation in the poisoning, the uncertainties over the involvement of the French authorities may yet go on for some years longer. It takes 75 years for some sensitive documents to be made public. Hidden in its small streets and stone buildings, Le Pont-Saint-Esprit drama has yet to reveal all its secrets.
Judging from the CIA's dark and notorious past of misconduct, perhaps it'll be no surprise if horrific clandestine high-tech experiments are being carried out somewhere in the world by the CIA at this very moment. Secrets that we must wait 75 years to be declassified, if ever disclosed to the public at all. And that's everyone for this week on Aperture. It's goodbye.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحیم السلام علیک یا سار الله
the sun, as arrows reach the sky, creation is in shock as you prepare to die. Everything you gave without complaint. You died a tragic death, but you did not die in vain. Hussein, Hussein, Hussein. Hussein, Hussein, Hussein. Hussein, Hussein,
Closer, Iran.
Hi, Mom. Don't worry, I'm okay. I'm just near the city of Abadan. Okay, I'll call you as soon as I arrive. Bye-bye. Traveled from Tehran to the southern province of Khuzestan to the city of Abadan. You know, today is Ashura, the 10th of the morning month of Muharram, which marks the tragic martyrdom of Imam Hussein and his companions. I'm going to have a tour around Abadan in order to see the special rituals of Ashura in this city, which I have heard is very impressive. Stay with me. Millions of Muslims in Iran and other countries commemorate the 10th day of Muharram, which marks the tragic martyrdom of Imam Hussein, peace upon him, and his loyal companions. For Muslims, Ashura marks the climax of the remembrance of Muharram and commemorates the martyrdom of Hussein ibn Ali, the grandson of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, at the Battle of Karbala on Muharram 10th in the year 61 AH, corresponding to 680 CE. In Ashura, Iranian Muslims, along with others from around the world, in a sign of unity, come to the streets and mark the day and send a message to the world that they will not surrender to the oppression of any power, no matter how big it is. These rituals are very impressive in the southern province of Khuzestan. The people of this province usually hold mourning ceremonies of the month of Muharram at homes, mosques, Husseinias, and tekiyas. From the cities of Dizful, Shushtar, Behbahan, and Ram Hormuz to Ahvaz and Abadan in this province. The lovers of Imam Hussein showed their love and devotion to him in the form of various programs. Arrived at Abadan. The ceremonies of Ashura have begun early in the morning. The entire city is full of big pieces of black cloth. And there are mukebs in every corner of the streets. Mukebs are tents erected along the way during the month of Muharram and Safar. These mukebs serve the mourners with cool water, tea, or food. Oh, a little boy wearing a black shirt and a green headband with the writing of Ya Hussein is coming toward me. Thank you. He brought me a glass of cool water. Salutations to Hussein, who was martyred while thirsty. Oh, over there is a huge crowd of people. Young and old are beating on their chests. In Khuzestan, there is an age-old tradition of a certain style of chest beating known as uniform chest beating or one chest beating. Uniform chest beating usually follows mourning ceremonies using cymbals and drums. Streets, Ta'ziyeh is performed reenacting the Battle of Karbala and the hardships suffered by Imam Hussein and his companions at the hands of the enemy forces. Oh, a big crowd of mourners have gathered here in order to watch Ta'ziyeh. Let me get closer. Very dramatic. A few meters away, Maqtal Khani ritual is being performed. In Maqtal Khani, the details of the tragic event of Ashura is described completely. Oh, everyone is shedding tears as the scenes of Ashura come in front of everyone's eyes. I was wondering that the love for Hussein never dies. It's like an inextinguishable fire in the heart of all freedom-seeking people of the world. Now it's time for the noon prayers of Ashura.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The leader's viewpoint on Imam Hussein's revolution and Ashura. Oppressors and tyrants wanted to eliminate the event of Husseini Ashura, but Zainab al-Kubra, God's greetings be upon her, did not allow this to happen. Our Lady Zainab, salamullah alayha, made two moves in order to do this. One was made during her capture and her transfer to Kufa and Sham, where she made illuminating and enlightening speeches. The other move was making a pilgrimage to Karbala in Arba'een. This was either the first or second Arba'een. This move means that we should not allow the malevolent motives which intend to erase dear, influential and important eras from memories to be successful. Of course, they will not be successful. As long as nations are alive, as long as truthful tongues speak, and as long as religious hearts are motivated, they will not be able to erase these errors and events, as they have not been successful until today. It is a glorious panorama in history, which has been presented to the entire humanity.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Imam Hussein, alayhi salam, prepared himself for such a day. Of course, the entire 50-plus year life of Hussein ibn Ali alayhi salam is a lesson. His childhood is a lesson. His youth is a lesson. His behavior during his imamate is a lesson. And his behavior after the martyrdom of Imam al-Hassan alayhi salam is a lesson. it was not the case that Imam Hussein's responsibility was confined to the last day. However, the event of Karbala enjoys such greatness and brightness that, like a sun, it overshadows all the other lights. Many people were martyred in the way of God, and alongside the Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, the Commander of the Faithful Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam, and divine prophets. But none of these events is comparable to the event of Karbala. There is a difference between a person who enters the arena with the praise and encouragement of friends and companions and with a hope of victory, and who is martyred in such conditions, and a person who enters the arena in a dark and gloomy world, while not only do all the great personalities of the world of Islam refuse to accompany him, but they also blame him for engaging in battle. The latter enters the arena while there is no hope of assistance from anyone. He enters the arena with a few sincere friends and with his family, including his wife, his sister, his nieces and nephews, his six-month-old son, and a few young members of his family, while his friends and supporters in Kufa refuse to accompany him. This is a strange event.
That you've done for me through all my years I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puriza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
With her trip to Taiwan this week, Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives Nancy Pelosi set off a firestorm in offending China. From the self-governing territory, Pelosi criticized Beijing and its leadership, while carefully outlining the limitations of the U.S. commitment to defend the island.
In the Congress, House and Senate, Democrats and Republicans are committed to the security of Taiwan in order to have Taiwan be able to most effectively defend themselves. But it also is about our shared values of democracy and freedom and how Taiwan has been an example to the world in that regard.
China had warned the U.S. and Pelosi against the visit, as it views Taiwan as a breakaway province that will one day rejoin a one China. In response to Pelosi's Taiwan visit, China's People's Liberation Army on Thursday began the largest military exercises targeting Taiwan in decades.
Tension in the situation across the Taiwan Strait is solely caused by the U.S. side.
The root cause is Pelosi's selfish and willful interference with Taiwan, which seriously violates the One China principle. The Chinese government has the right to take all necessary and justified actions to firmly safeguard its national sovereignty and territorial integrity.